New York Times bestselling author Jodi Picoult will have a special event at the Clark Art Institute on Saturday, the 8th of October, to mark the debut of her new novel, Small Great Things. Picoult will discuss what she considers her most personal novel to date, an author talk scheduled for 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock, and there are book signings also scheduled at 2 and at 5. You can find out more information by going to clarkart.edu. Again, the name of the new book is Small Great Things, and it's a great pleasure to welcome novelist Jodi Picoult to the roundtable this morning. Jodi, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you back on the program.
Well, thanks, Joe.
Before we talk about the event and talk about writing overall, tell us a little bit about Small Great Things and how this particular novel came about.
Well, I actually wanted to write about racism for a very, very long time. I started a book 20 years ago after being deeply moved by a real-life incident in New York City when I was living there, where an African-American undercover cop was shot 4 times in the back by his white colleagues on the subway, even though he was wearing what was called the color of the day, a wristband that identified him as an undercover cop. I started the book, and eventually I wound up abandoning it because I just could not create an authentic voice. And, you know, I really second-guessed myself. Did I have the right to tell this story? It wasn't my story. I'm not a person of color. There are plenty of terrific writers of color doing a great job of it without me. You know, and then as the years went on, I would come back, circle back, and I would play devil's advocate. You know, I'd say, well, you know, you write all the time in the point of view of a person you're not. You've written as men. You've written as school shooters. You've written as rape victims. You're none of those people either. So why is this different? Well, I think it's because race is different and racism is different. We can't really talk about it without offending people. And so as a result, we often choose not to talk about it at all. So fast forward to 2012, and again, I come across another news story. This is from Flint, Michigan. There is a nurse there who works in a hospital with 20 years of experience on the labor and delivery ward. She helps deliver a baby, and the father calls in her supervisor and asks that this nurse and nobody who looked like her be allowed to touch his infant. And he pulls up his sleeve to reveal a swastika tattoo. He was a white supremacist. In their infinite wisdom, the hospital put a post-it note on the baby's file saying, no African-American personnel to touch this infant. The nurse sued. She settled out of court. I hope she got a giant payout. But it made me think, what if? What if she'd been the only one with the baby when something went wrong? What if she had to choose between saving that baby's life or following her supervisor's orders? What if she wound up on trial with a white public defender who, like me, like many people I know, would never consider themselves to be racists, but, you know, that's who's defending this particular nurse? What if the story was told by 3 characters, the nurse, the white public defender, and the white supremacist dad, as all of them tried to reexamine their beliefs about power and prejudice and privilege? So, and all of a sudden, I knew I could write this book. And the difference was, it was to a different audience, and it was for a different reason. I wasn't trying to write a book about how hard life is for a person of color. Because you know what? That isn't my story to tell, and I should never write that book. I was writing to white people, and I was writing to say, hey, open your eyes. It's really easy to point to a white supremacist and say that's a racist. It's a little harder to point to yourself and say the same thing. And yet racism isn't just about prejudice. It's also about power. And if you're born white in this world, in this society, you hold all the power. And therefore, you are complicit in racism. And so ultimately, that was how the book came about.
The nurse in the story is Ruth Jefferson. Did it start there for you that you knew you wanted to include her voice?
I couldn't have written this book without her voice. And that's a really interesting conundrum because, again, do I have the right to write a voice of color? That
right.
has been a very hot topic in the past few weeks. And, you know, no one is going to tell a writer, you can't write this voice. I mean, you know, look, we're writers and we write other for a living. But it's okay to tell a writer, hey, if you're writing a voice other than your own, first ask yourself why. Are you doing it to profit off someone else's pain? Or are you doing it because there's a bigger reason that requires that voice? And second, if you are going to write that voice, how are you going to make sure that you do it with empathy and sensitivity? And in my case, I couldn't write about racism without including Ruth's voice in this story. Kennedy, who is the white public defender, is the foil to her voice. She's the voice who was the one I had complete legitimacy to write because, you know, like her, I had to start a journey against racism somewhere. And we see Kennedy's development over the course of this book as she realizes she is a good person, but that doesn't mean that she hasn't been part of the problem. And when it came to Ruth, though, I really had to think about how to write that voice. And I was fortunate enough to find a group of women of color to do over 100 hours of interview with them, where they shared their stories with me, their hopes, their fears, their failures, their successes, incredibly personal and moving stories. Like, for example, the young mom who is holding this adorable little baby boy who comes in tears because that morning on the news is yet another story of an unarmed African-American man who is shot by the police. And she said, "How do I keep my baby safe? How do I teach him when he grows up to not be black?" Or the young woman who used to carry her Vassar water bottle with her on all public transportation and put it facing out so that everyone could read the word Vassar, as if she could tell the white people walking past her, "It's okay, you can sit here, I'm safe." Mm-hmm. Those are very affecting and deeply moving stories. And the fact that these women shared them with me and overlooked my ignorance about their lives, that's an incredible gift to me. And they also then were my sensitivity readers. When I wrote the voice of Ruth, they went through it with a fine-tooth comb, making corrections and suggestions so that they could vet the fact that she would sound authentic and the way that they thought she should sound, that she would say the things that she said, that if I was screwing up because I was, you know, putting a white spin on a black character, they could fix that for me. And so I'm really, really grateful to them. I could not have written this book without those women.
You described a moment ago the process that you went through of writing this particular story. And in having many conversations with you in the past, that's similar to how you go about most books in the sense of finding a subject of what you want to write about it and then going all in.
Yeah, I like doing that. I really am a big fan of research, mostly because I'm a reader too, and I hate catching an inaccuracy in a book. I think it pulls you out of the story. So in this case, this book was a little different because I couldn't ask my readers to unpack their biases unless I unpack mine. And that meant really coming to terms with some things that I've been doing wrong my whole life, that I didn't think a lot about racism. I didn't have to. That's a privilege. You know, and I went to social justice workshops where I went in there thinking, well, I'm open-minded, I'm a pretty good person, and I left there in tears every night as I heard these stories from people of color that really were horribly upsetting to me and that made me realize there were things in my past that I had glossed over that absolutely were moments of racism. Even growing up as a child, it was revisiting my life and seeing it from a whole new prism. I think that it's really easy for us to see the headwinds of racism, the ways that it's difficult to achieve success if you're a person of color in America. It's a little harder for white people to see the tailwinds of racism. And by that, I mean the way that opportunities and successes come easily to white people in a way that we attribute to luck or hard work. Very often those successes are the direct result of the fact that a person of color did not have the same opportunity. And it's something that we don't think about because, again, we don't have to. And that, again, is an advantage. But think, for example, you might have an apartment because your landlord didn't want to rent to a person of color. And you may not even know that. Or maybe you went to a great college because you did really well on your SATs. And that's because when you were a kid, your mom was home to read to you every night before bedtime, whereas a person of color's mom was working three jobs to make ends meet. You know, when you begin to unpack all of the advantages that you've had as a white person over the course of your life, it's very shocking. And suddenly the American dream doesn't look quite as dreamy. And it requires a real mind shift in the way that you see the world. It's something that definitely occurred for me while I was writing this book. This book changed me very, very deeply. I can't not see race now, and I talk about it constantly. And I would much rather do that, knowing I may screw up, I may say something wrong, I may make a mistake. But then I can say, you know, I'm so sorry, help me. What do I need to say? Learn from that and move on. It's a lot more important for us to start talking about race than to sweep it under the carpet, because it's hard to talk about.
I am fascinated by, you alluded to this earlier, and I just want to talk about it for a moment, and that is this idea of what you're writing about in many cases is, of course, playing out on the streets across this country. And I'm interested in as a writer, does it concern you or does it challenge you when you know that at the end of a day when we're besieged with headlines on these very issues and we're talking about what is going on between police and African Americans, what's happening in regards to race in our inner cities and as well as the suburbs, and then for someone to be immersed in all of these headlines and then to sit down and read your book as entertainment? So of saying, oh, okay, what can I add to that conversation and still tell a really good story?
Well, you know, there is a difference between nonfiction and fiction. And very often, I think fiction is a great way to broach a subject that is difficult to talk about. I used to talk a lot about this when I wrote, for example, Perfect Match, which was about sexual abuse in the church. You can read the Vatican reports on that, but very few people do. But you might read a novel about it and wind up talking about it after the book is closed. And I think that this book functions the same way. In a way, this book is I think, even more important. I will go back and just say one thing, which is the stories that we're seeing in the news right now make this topic relevant and timely. I would argue this has been relevant and timely for the past 200 years. The difference is that with social media, with 24/7 news coverage, we are hearing about these assaults much more frequently and much more comprehensively. The world's gotten a little smaller because of technology, but the division and the oppression of African Americans has not changed in 200 years, I would say. But, you know, I think that a lot of white people hear about this stuff in the news. And at least I'll speak for myself. I know that when I hear about a shooting, I feel sick. I sometimes want to say something on social media to say, you know, I'm standing in solidarity. I'm so sorry this happened. And I don't know how to say it. And I think that's the problem with racism. People don't have a vocabulary to enter this dialogue, to enter this conversation, even if they want to. It is my hope that by reading a piece of fiction, you can start by talking about Ruth and Kennedy, the characters in this book, about Turk, the white supremacist. You can have a dialogue that begins fictionally and segue into reality. I'd like to believe two things, that this book can give white people the vocabulary they need to start this conversation, if they haven't already. And second, that it opens you up to the voices that you may not have heard. One thing that I tell people to do, because it's super easy, is to go look at your bookshelf. How many authors of color are on it? If you read a white author, do you then read an author of color next? And if not, why not? And I challenge people to finish Small Great Things, and then to go pick up a book written by an author of color, because they are far more qualified than I am to tell you what life is like to be a person of color in the U.S. And you need to hear that voice, and you need to hear it from someone who has lived through it. And I really hope that this book inspires people to do that, to widen their range a little bit and to hear a voice maybe that they haven't listened to.
Jodi Picco will be at the Clark Art Institute for a special event to mark the debut of her new novel, Small Great Things, on Saturday, the 8th of October. There will be talks at 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock, with book signings scheduled at 2 and at 5. You can find out more information by going to clarkart.edu. Clarkart.edu. Again, the name of the new novel, Small Great Things. Jody Picco, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for being with us, and it'll be very nice to have you in the region on Saturday the 8th.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Again, Jody Picco's new novel is Small Great Things. She'll be at the Clark Art Institute on Saturday, October 8th. You can find out more at clarkart.edu. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.